Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show for you. Our guest is going to be Jonathan Adelstein, member of the Federal Communications Commission. The Honorable Mr. Adelstein will be joining us today to discuss the full range of media policy issues that the FCC is considering, from minority ownership, media ownership, internet access, privacy, cell phones, the whole works. We're going to get the inside story today, and you'll have a chance to speak with him. So stay tuned for our show today. But first, before we get to Honorable Mr. Adelstein, listen to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Motion Picture Association of America, alongside large broadband service providers like Comcast and AT&T, has mounted a multi-million dollar campaign against net neutrality, the fundamental internet principle that prevents discrimination against websites and services. The MPAA claims that it needs to combat piracy and that net neutrality makes it too easy for pirates to operate. They want the power to block file sharing applications like BitTorrent on their networks. But others in the entertainment industry disagree. Jonathan Rintels is president and executive director of the Center for Creative Voices in Media. His group of media makers, writers, actors, producers, and directors, is also very concerned about piracy. But, Rintels says, the MPAA's fight against piracy is just a smokescreen for what big media really wants.
It is a way for the large media companies, in alliance with the cable and telephone companies, to direct their customers to their approved media sites and to degrade, shut down, anti-competitively harm other media sites that are favored by independent media artists that aren't part of big media.
In fact, just after MPAA President Dan Glickman attacked net neutrality in a high-profile speech, the big movie studios launched their own video website, Hulu.com, to stream video.
Hulu.com is jointly owned by NBC Universal and News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, Fox, and distributes not only the video of those companies, but also Sony, Warner's, and other members of the MPAA.
Rintels says that the cable and phone companies want to make the internet more like cable television, where they have control over what people see.
They sell that access to the highest bidder, and the highest bidder is going to be big media.
Rintels says that broadband was the great dream for independent media makers who could work with low-cost methods of production and distribution to reach their audience.
As independent media artists, we have seen this movie. We know how it ends, and it's not good for independent and diverse media. That's why it's so critical that we have a level playing field, an open internet, and that requires net neutrality.
For more information, go to creativevoices.us.
Drawing visual images as a way of protest has been part of Western culture since the early 1500s. In colonial America, the political cartoon was used by Benjamin Franklin, and it has been an important vehicle for democratic expression ever since. Every American newspaper and magazine once had at least one political cartoonist on staff, and often the names of the cartoonists were synonymous with the publications themselves. In today's media, political cartoons are becoming scarce. Cartoonists have been disappearing at an alarming rate, from more than 2,000 during the first part of the 20th century to less than 90 today. Milt Prigge, former cartoonist for Crane's Chicago Business and the Spokane Spokesman Review, says newspapers once understood the value of a good editorial cartoonist, but times have changed.
The profession of a staff editorial cartoonist is dead. The environment, the fiscal and ethical environment, no longer exists as it once did. The job description of a staff editorial cartoonist was to editorialize and provoke. That has now devolved to address and entertain.
Prigge says cartoonists were let go as soon as consolidation set in, and most places became one-newspaper towns.
Once that competition was gone, then all of a sudden this newspaper is playing to both sides of the audience, the left and the right. And now you have the possibility of getting half of your audience upset, and the publisher does not see any benefit because there is no competition. He's not competing against anybody.
Political cartoons are not comic strips. They are what Prigge calls a biased exaggeration of the facts, and they are an important vehicle to encourage democratic debate. Prigge laments that most publishers today want someone to simply illustrate the news.
Don't get anybody upset. Don't provoke debate. I do not want the phone to ring. Whereas before, that was the very reason you were hired, was to make the phone ring. You know, to make the editorial page a very exciting place for readers to go, whereas the editorial page a lot of time has been, you know, kind of boring.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, March 23rd, 2008. We're very privileged today to have as our guest on the phone lines the Honorable Jonathan Adelstein, member of the Federal Communications Commission since 2002. And we're glad to say at one time a guest on the show just a couple of years ago, no doubt the high point in his career. Commissioner Adelstein, welcome back to Media Matters.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's great to be back. It was a highlight.
Well, I was being facetious, but that's a sad statement that I guess about the FCC commissioners' lives. There's so much to talk about that's been going on at the Federal Communications Commission, and since we last spoke in the last year on the internet, on media ownership, on privacy, there's a long list of topics we need to go over. But I think for the sake of many of our listeners who've heard the name FCC, they know what it means, Federal Communications Commission, but they really don't know much else about it. Maybe we should start with some ABCs of the FCC, just to get all our listeners on the same page here. What is the Federal Communications Commission, and what does it do?
We are an agency that oversees all of the wireline and wireless communications in the country. It began back in the 30s to regulate radio so that instead of just having people set up radio stations and broadcast wherever they wanted, we coordinated to make sure that every radio station had its own place, like 8:30 on the AM dial, and we would monitor for interference or anybody that would illegally use that. And it grew up also then to oversee what was then AT&T, the phone system. And as time evolved, we oversee then all wireless communications that are commercial in nature, not government, but commercial. So we oversee your satellite services, including your DBS television and cell phones and private radio and, of course, the media, which goes over the television and radio broadcast spectrum. So we're doing wireline, wireless, and the media. It's a pretty full plate. It encompasses, if you look at all of the different industries we oversee, about 1/6 of the economy. And there are five of us that run the commission. We have about 2,000 employees, but the five of us who are commissioners, no more than three can be from the same party. That's the president's party. So in this case, you have three Republicans, and I'm one of the two Democrats on the commission.
And how does someone get to be on the FCC? Is it run for public office? What's the process?
Well, we're all appointed by the president and confirmed by the United States Senate. I happen to be appointed by George Bush at the recommendation of the Senate Democrats. Recently, the president's been taking the recommendation of the opposition party in Congress. And so though I'm a Bush appointee, I'm actually recommended by the Senate Democratic Caucus of the then Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who I used to happen to work for.
Now, is the FCC, it is an agency that is singularly powerful. Like you said, it deals with a huge amount of the economy, not to mention the political implications of the FCC. But what also distinguishes the FCC is that you grant monopoly licenses and then issue regulations on how these licenses can be used. So you don't just regulate industries that are emerging or exist on their own. You're creating the industries.
We have created some great industries. We've done well sometimes to try to create competition. For example, creating the, we mentioned satellite television industry to compete with cable. And when you talk about monopoly, in a sense, it is a monopoly, even though there's a lot of television stations, for example. We will give one owner or monopoly on Channel 4. We'll make sure that nobody else can operate on Channel 4 in Champaign-Urbana, and we will keep everybody else off. If they try to interfere, we'll send our little police down there and try to shut them down so that that person has a right to operate on that license uniquely. And in return, of course, we ask that that operator, or broadcast licensee as we call them, serves the public interest. We'll protect their right to broadcast, but they need to do something in return for using the free spectrum by serving the public interest. And recently they haven't done as well as they used to.
Our guest today, Jonathan Adelstein, FCC member, commissioner. It's our privilege to welcome to the air here at Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're going to be talking about the full range of issues the FCC is considering, some exceptionally important ones concerning media ownership, the future of the Internet, privacy online, cell phones. The number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Commissioner Adelstein and I right now are simply sort of going through some of the basics of how the FCC works to get everyone on the same page. Commissioner Adelstein, what is the relationship of the FCC to Congress? And let me put it in context. We know that an institution like the Supreme Court, its members are likewise approved by Congress and nominated by the president. But then once they're in office, they're pretty much on their own. And there's really nothing else the president or Congress can do to mess with them. The Supreme Court has real, in this court system, has autonomy for the most part, barring impeachment, which is almost impossible to do. How about the FCC? What's the nature of its relationship to the executive and especially to Congress?
Well, there's a lot of different interpretations of that, but certainly we are considered a creature of Congress. We're an independent agency, so we're not technically part of the regular executive branch or subject to the president's control. Each one of us is independent. We're nominated and confirmed for a fixed term. Now, these are five-year terms, so generally speaking, if we want to get re-upped or not, depending, you know, it could be something where the Congress could hold that over our heads and attempt to use that for leverage. It may or may not work, depending on the character of the commissioner involved. Certainly, the Congress sees us as their agent or their body that will carry out the law. And our job is to carry out the laws that Congress passes. Of course, the courts oversee us, but we're independent, but far less independent than, say, the Supreme Court, because we can regularly be called up in front of Congress. And right now, for example, the House Commerce Committee that oversees us is engaged in probably the most far-reaching investigation of the FCC that we've ever been subject to in our history since 1934. Matter of fact, here it is Easter, and I'm in the office today trying to go through a bunch of old emails that they want me to send up to them.
What is the reason for this House investigation of the SEC? What brought this about after, you know, 74 years?
Well, they say that they have allegations of abusive practices by our chairman, Kevin Martin, that they want to look into. So there really been a lot of complaints about how he handles the staff and the process by which he manages the agency and the way that he sometimes tries to twist the studies or information to serve his policy goals rather than to try to find the truth. I mean, theoretically, we should be an independent agency that just does what it can to ascertain reality and try to reflect that in our rulings based on what Congress asked us to do. And it seems that Congress believes, anyway, that we are losing sight of that responsibility and trying to veer off into various directions that the chairman sees fit rather than what Congress intended.
And one of the things, Commissioner Adelstein, that's particular to the FCC compared to the U.S. Supreme Court is that the chair of the FCC, in this case Kevin Martin, has exceptional amount of power relative to the other four members of the FCC.
Yeah, he does and he doesn't. He has no more votes than we do. He only has one vote and he needs three to get things done. But he sets the agenda. He can decide what we vote on, when we vote on it, and he sends up the first draft, but then he proposes and the full commission disposes. So the power of setting the agenda is enormously important because, for example, I talked about public interest obligations. In 1999, the commission did a very preliminary question about that, but it's never gotten past that because the chairman, both this one and Chairman Powell before him, never wanted to bring it up and put it on our agenda. So because they're not interested in public interest obligations of broadcasters, we haven't had the chance to vote on it, despite repeated pleas from me and my colleague, Commissioner Mike Copps.
Our guest today, again, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, who we have the privilege and honor of speaking with on Media Matters. We're going to be talking about the full range of issues in front of the FCC during the course of the hour, and we welcome phone calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. But in the meantime, we're sort of getting up to speed on how the FCC works. And I just have one final area I want to go with, Commissioner, and this is probably the giant elephant in the room whenever you talk about the FCC, which is, you know, the nature of the FCC's relationship historically through to the present day with private industry.
Well, there is a real revolving door here that we see. The private industry, certain industries that we oversee closely, like the big phone companies that have been subject to us since the 1930s, have really evolved a special sensitivity and ability to kind of manipulate the process. One of the ways they do that is by hiring the best and brightest from the FCC. We are all subject to government salaries, which, you know, aren't quite as well paid as the private sector, and a really well-qualified, like one of our best staffers, rises to the top here, can turn around and nearly double their salary by going to a big telecommunications company or a large media company. And the more money that a company has to offer, the better staff they can cherry-pick from the FCC. So the result is that the biggest and most powerful companies with the most money tend to be able to get the most influence because they can hire the best people with the best access and the best understanding of the system, on top of hiring the best lawyers to back them up. So the natural tendency is for there to be something of a little vacuum here where there's a small world of telecom specialists in Washington. Most of them have paid their dues by being at the FCC, but then they hop right out and go to the private sector. Now, sometimes that might influence them while they're here. I hope generally not, that they do their work here as public servants and then go on. But even if they aren't influenced by their desire someday to go out into the private sector and make their killing, it's a corrupting process nonetheless, because eventually they will leave and probably work for private industry, and private industry will get excellent representation. So there's a corrupting influence sometimes before, but certainly after a person goes through the revolving door. It's not corruption in the sense of illegality, but it's almost institutionalized.
Yeah, I think one way to put it, Commissioner Adelstein, is that even if the people are entirely ethical and certainly are going to do their best and they work at the FCC, they're in an environment where the people there, the commercial interests that have a stake in their decisions, monitor what the FCC does extremely closely. Their trade press covers it closely. And the rest of the American people know very little about it as a rule. The vast majority of Americans won't know about the issues we'll be talking about in this show, but the commercial interests know all about them.
There's a very specialized, what we call the Federal Communications Bar. People generally that do have FCC experience and that know what's going on, and you're right, it's kind of a closed network. The public has a right to comment, but they never hear about things that can be far-reaching in their import. Occasionally we break through that, as we did on media ownership, which we'll talk about, but for the most part, there is sort of a interesting dynamic here that doesn't always reflect, in the end, what's best for the American people, but reflects what's best for the companies we oversee. I think it's called, in the political science literature that your students study, agency capture.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan Adelstein, let's now get down to brass tacks. You know, the issue, I think, that put the FCC in the public spotlight in a way that had never been in the public spotlight historically was 5 years ago, just after you joined the FCC, when it began to review the media ownership rules for firms in the United States, which generated millions of people sort of rising and voicing opposition to the idea of allowing consolidated media. The courts in 2004 threw out the Republican-approved plan the FCC had passed, and Congress had already thrown out elements of it. But that's come back on the table in the last year to yet another FCC review. And could you just sort of outline what has taken place in the last 2 years on media ownership at the FCC from your perspective and where we stand?
Well, as you said, in 2003, then Chairman Powell attempted what would have been the most destructive rollback of media ownership protections in the history of American broadcasting. Fortunately, the courts the next year put the whole decision on ice pending review by the FCC, said go back, this was done so poorly that you need to go back from scratch and do it again. And finally, in 2006-2007, Chairman Martin dusted that off and went back to the drawing board and agreed with me and Mike Copps to hold a series of a half a dozen hearings across the country, commissioned 10 media ownership studies that apparently were designed to fulfill the goals he had in mind. And his goal was to loosen the media cross-ownership rules that prevented newspapers from buying television or radio stations in the same community that they operate in. In the end, he had his way because just in December, against the advice of our congressional overseers, he pushed through on a party line 3-2 vote an order that would have relaxed the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, making it presumptive that it would be okay in the top 20 markets of the country where over half the population lives, but allowing waivers in the rest of the markets in the country. So now in virtually any community in America, there could be a newspaper, your local newspaper could buy up a TV or radio station.
And basically, in effect, what that means, looking at the historical pattern, is that a single company could have one newsroom serving a multitude of media. So you might have a lot of media in your community, but there'd only be one, or maybe, if you're lucky, two newsrooms, actually the journalists covering it.
Yes, as Senator Dorgan said, it's like having many voices, but all coming from the same ventriloquist.
And on this issue, how you were attended these six hearings, these were really, in many respects, a revolutionary development in policymaking for the SEC that started in 2003 informally, and then thanks to you and Commissioner Copps, became a formal part of the process in the last 2 years. You went around the country, you had six public hearings to get public input, not just lobbyist input on what people think about media in their communities, what they think the media ownership rules should be shaped like. What did you learn in those six hearings, Commissioner Adelstein?
Well, we learned an enormous amount. We learned basically that the American people don't want to see big media get even bigger. It was a real new development to go out and listen to people. And an organization you co-founded, Free Press, helped us along the way because in the early days, back in 2003, when Mike Copps and I decided to go on the road, and he's my fellow Democratic commissioner, we really hadn't done that. We were pioneering that, and we managed to convince the chairman then to do just one hearing before his disastrous 2003 decision. But we did literally dozens of them, talked to a lot of people in communities large and small across the country. And then the chairman, Powell, decided to have a localism proceeding where we do more hearings. And then when Chairman Martin decided to do this, he heeded our request. We wanted more than six hearings, but six hearings was still unprecedented. Never before had the FCC gone out and really talked to people. Now, it was entirely appropriate in this case because the law is fairly vague. It says we're supposed to pursue the public interest. How can you know what the public interest is without going out and talking to the public and really getting outside the beltway and hearing what people have to say? What we did here was a virtually unanimous chorus from people on the political left to the right, and virtually everybody in between felt that it wasn't a good idea to allow more media consolidation, to allow locally owned outlets in their communities to be bought up by big multinational media conglomerates that might be based out of town or on the coasts. We really heard an earful, and despite that, we went directly against what we heard from people in community after community, and did what the chairman wanted to do all along, which was relax the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule without regard to what the public wanted.
You know, this almost sounds surreal to me. I had a chance to watch on the computer a couple of these hearings that they were broadcast online, but I couldn't really get a sense because I was restricted by what the camera would show to see how the proceedings were unfolding with all the members while the testimony was going on. But what were the three Republicans doing during these hearings that could make it possible for them to sit through six hearings like that across the country, all parts of the country, all different elements of our population, and still come away and just sort of completely disregard it? It's astounding to me.
Well, I don't want to characterize them. They certainly appeared to be listening intently.
Okay, I didn't mean to suggest they were sleeping, but I'm just sort of curious what their faculties were.
Not sure. I mean, one of them, to go unnamed, looked like he was thoroughly pained by the proceedings, who happened to be the chairman.
But he's going unnamed nonetheless.
But he did go through them, and, it was to his credit that he did that. And the last hearing was particularly explosive. We went to Seattle, Washington, right as he was about to stick the knife into the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule, and the public virtually erupted in anger about what was going on and asked if what they were doing had been a sham. And sure enough, right after the hearing, there was an article published in the New York Times about what he planned to do that had been written apparently before even hearing from the people of Seattle.
Well, where does it stand now? The vote went through, it's 3-2, so the new rules are in place, but that happened also in 2003, and Congress visited them, and then they were thrown out by the courts. Is that what's on the agenda right now or on the horizon, do you think?
Well, it certainly is being challenged in court. Our December decision from last year has been challenged by the same group that challenged successfully the rules in 2003. Now, I think, frankly, that this is a lot less juicy of a target for the courts. The Third Circuit, which was the court that threw out the rules in 2004, did say that there was room for change in the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. They didn't say what that could be. But here we made changes that the FCC is arguing are modest. Mike Hobson, I think that they're not so modest, but you can make the case that, oh, it's just the top 20 markets, we drew reasonable distinctions. And frankly, you know, a victory for the people who organized and fought for all those years, none of the other rules were changed. In other words, all the decisions made in 2003 were reversed by the FCC, and the only relaxation of the rules was in the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, and even then, it was allegedly limited to the top 20 markets. Now, we can have a debate about whether or not the waivers in the rest of the markets in the country are loose or not. I certainly think they're about as stiff as a wet noodle. But the chairman and his lawyers will argue in court that, no, these are real. But I'll tell you one thing, if the Democrats do win, I expect that people like Mike Copps and I are here. We're certainly going to enforce those waiver standards very strictly. And you won't see many waivers probably unless they're highly justified outside the top 20 markets, if any are approved at all.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580 coming from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the Honorable Jonathan Adelstein, Federal Communications Commission member since 2002, now in the home stretch of his second term, or hope it's leading to a third term come 2009. We have two callers who have been waiting patiently, and I'm going to get to the lines right now. If you'd like to join them, the phone number again here at WILL, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to that toll-free line right now. Line 4, Indiana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Commissioner Adelstein.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My questions relate to the topic you're on about the recent ownership rules and challenging those and the Democrats to winning the next election, but specifically relating to the 700 megahertz spectrum that is going to be or is up for grabs, and I guess we're in the middle of the auction now. I wanted to get some clarity on how that is going to work. Could the rules potentially be changed before that spectrum is given to anyone? And how the auction works, what are some of the potential uses of that spectrum, and just what he sees coming about in that regard?
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Commissioner, before you go into any detail, I think it would be best if, for the sake of many of our listeners who, when they hear the term spectrum and auction, their eyes begin to glaze, that you give some background about this very important, historic auction of spectrum, what we mean by when we say you auction spectrum, what's at stake here, and what has taken place so far. And I know you have very strong opinions about this.
Well, this actually is very exciting. The auction actually closed last week. I don't know if our callers heard that, but I'll set it up for everybody else. The spectrum that we're selling is a spectrum that is currently being used by your television stations on the UHF channel, some of the upper UHF channels, like from channel 52 to 64 or something like that. Those channels up there are being vacated. We're moving all these broadcasters to digital television, so you can get high-definition digital TV, and a broadcaster can get more than one channel squeezed into the digital spectrum, whereas before they only had one channel. You're on your channel 4, become 4-2 and 4-3. So we're making this digital transition. As part of that, we're reclaiming some of the spectrum that was being used by broadcasters, and we're selling it to the highest bidder. And the auction just finished, as a matter of fact, last week. This is the so-called 700 megahertz auction, because that's the frequency where the television stations were broadcasting. The auction was probably the largest and most important that we'll hold for many years to come, or that we have held for many years, because The spectrum is what we call beachfront property in the radio world. It goes through walls, just as you can put your television on. You can watch Channel 55 in your living room because that is very powerful spectrum. It allows these signals to go right through walls and into buildings, and very strong signals. So it's wonderful spectrum, and we just sold it for a record nearly $20 billion to the highest bidder. Now, guess who won most of the spectrum? You guessed it. It's the largest telecommunications companies in America. AT&T and Verizon won about 80% of the spectrum by some estimates. And the little companies bought pieces here and there around the country. But, for example, you know, the caller asked about what are the implications, how did it go, can you change the rules? Basically, it's too late to change the rules. The rules were set, and the auction went, and everything's been sold now, so you can't go back and change the rules afterwards. But take, for example, women and people of color who historically haven't really owned a lot of the national spectrum. Of the 1,090 licenses that we sold, zero, I repeat, zero were won by women, and just, I think it was seven, were won by minorities. So you're talking about less than 0.5% by people of color who represent 1/3 of the United States, and zero by women who are over half of our population. And meanwhile, these gargantuan companies that already control the wireline infrastructure bought the wireless spectrum. Now, why is that significant? You ask, what is important about this? The idea of how the spectrum is going to be used is used for broadband, for wireless broadband. So a person doesn't necessarily have to use the phone company or the cable company. If a new company came in and won the spectrum, they could use it for wireless broadband that would work anywhere in your house, and it could compete. They wouldn't have to build a phone line to your house or a cable line to your house. Any company that bought the spectrum could just set up a broadband system throughout, for example, Champaign, Illinois, and cover the city with spectrum that you could use for broadband. What's going to happen now is I think you're going to find Verizon and AT&T are going to use this for their wireless broadband offerings, which is wonderful, and people will have a choice at least. It'll be mobile, but it's not going to compete. They're not going to want to cannibalize their own broadband offering. So we're not going to get the kind of broadband competition that we really hope for as a result of this auction.
I mean, these guys already are existing huge players in the duopoly with the phone and cable companies, so they're not going to have any incentive to offer a third leg in the competition.
That's right. Currently, 96% of Americans get their broadband from either their cable company or their phone company, either through DSL or cable modem. So we're going to see maybe a new option that's going to be appended onto that, but you're only going to entrench further the existing duopoly, and they paid a pretty penny for that right, and the reason they can pay that much is that it's worth it for them to extend their franchise and, frankly, to keep out competition.
Now, is this, when you say the spectrum is sold to them, is it permanent? They own it for the next 500 million years, or is there a term on it?
I believe there is a term on it, but it's almost automatic renewal. There's no requirement that they serve the public interest. They simply have to meet certain requirements we laid out. For example, we laid out, I believe they're 10-year licenses, and we laid out some build-out requirements and some other things like that. If they meet very basic specs that we laid out for them, and they will be able to automatically get those renewed. So they really bought it virtually for infinity, but we'll see how that works. So often they get sold or, you know, moved around, and that's how they change hands.
Now, there have been a number of people on the Internet over the past year who have been very upset about the idea that we're selling off spectrum, similar to the idea of selling off a national park to develop real estate developers. And was this a decision you had any control over at the SEC, or was this something that Congress basically said, you've got to do it?
Well, we did have some control over it. Congress basically said that if we're going to give out spectrum, that we needed to do it through an auction mechanism. But we could have put more of this or some of this towards unlicensed use, which we have the ability to do without necessarily getting congressional approval. And that would have kept it in the open domain so that people could have gone out and set up wireless, you know, internet service providers in communities and come up with their own unique community-based approaches to getting around the duopoly, but we didn't do that. We didn't set aside any of it for unlicensed use. If we're going to license it, if we're going to give it to anybody to use on a permanent basis, the Congress did require us to sell it at auction. So we didn't have any flexibility there, but certainly We could have given some unlicensed use, which is, I think, what a lot of folks you're talking about wanted us to do.
How about yourself? Where did you stand on that issue?
Well, I was really hopeful that we could set aside some for unlicensed use, but there was just no support for that here in the commission. We couldn't get that bandwagon rolling, unfortunately. So we all kind of acceded to the fact it was going to be all sold, and we tried to attach rules that would have ensured a third provider came in. For example, we wanted to take a section of the spectrum and sell it off to a company that would promise to wholesale it, would promise to sell it to third parties, would have to have an open system, but we couldn't get agreement on that. We did, to the chairman's credit, for the first time, require that the company that bought that same block of spectrum, which in the end turned out to be Verizon Wireless, has to provide open access to devices and applications so that you can bring your own devices to that spectrum, and it's going to be laid out under an open standard. So at least, you know, if you buy a cell phone that uses that, or a broadband device that uses that spectrum, you can then take it to any other place that you want.
You know, before we go to our next caller who's been waiting patiently, Commissioner Alstein, I mean, if I understand what you're saying, what's taken place with very little public awareness in the past week when this auction being completed is that we've more or less locked in the relevant spectrum for how we have the potential to change or alter broadband system in this country. And possibly, in fact, based on what you're saying, arguably, this is not going to be necessarily seen as one of the great moments in American history down the road.
I think we'll look back at it as a huge missed opportunity to enhance broadband competition. And here in broadband, we're falling behind our international competitors. The good news is that we're ahead of Estonia, but the bad news is we're behind Latvia, I think it is. So, you know, we're 20th in the world by some measures, 15th by others. And what are we doing about it? Are we enhancing competition so that we can see lower prices? We're paying much more per megabit than our competitors around the world. And what are we doing about it? We're basically selling the spectrum off to the highest bidder, which in this case are the ones that already control.
And industries, if I may interject, that as a rule rank among the single most unpopular industries with consumers in our economy.
Well, if you liked them before, you're going to better keep liking them because they're going to have an even more extensive reach into your ability to communicate.
Our guest today, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein of the FCC, we have a full bank of callers here at Media Matters and WILL. Let's get back to the phone lines right now. I promise I'm going to get to all our callers today. Line one, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Commissioner Adelstein.
Yeah, first I want to commend the commissioner for his fight, you know, for the struggling for the people. My major concern is, you know, the future of the Internet, you know, certainly net neutrality. If not, what we're going to do is we're going to see the same scenario that we saw, that we now see in the mass media, you know. So anyway, I'll just go off the air and let you comment.
I think that's right. The purpose of this net neutrality battle is to keep the broadband Internet world from looking like the old media, which is dominated by a handful of corporate giants. Even if there are a couple of giants that dominate the infrastructure, be it the phone and the cable infrastructure, as long as people can communicate freely and openly over them, then we're hoping that the grip, and particularly vertically integrated companies that have their own media content, will be loosened, and there'll be other ways that people can get around that domination. But to the extent that these companies can clamp down and become gatekeepers, the fear is that we will lose that openness, that neutrality that has always been the hallmark of the Internet. That is a monumental issue, I think, again, as Bob put it, that will be looked at from years to come as to whether or not we did our responsibility, whether we met our responsibility to ensure that there is a free and open Internet so that people can communicate with each other with the kind of a freedom from corporate control that people have grown to expect and have learned to love on the Internet.
Commissioner Adelstein, one of the new developments at the FCC this year, just starting in April, I believe, in February, and then going forward, is that the FCC is now holding a series of public hearings on the future of the Internet to get public input. Hopefully these will have a little more consequence than the hearings on media ownership apparently did. One of these was held in Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard. Another one is coming up next month at Stanford in Palo Alto, California. What's the source of these hearings? What's the purpose of them, and what do you think it could come out of them?
Well, we're looking at the issue of network management and net neutrality at these hearings. And I'm looking forward to going back to my alma mater. I'm an old Stanford grad. No place better, as far as I'm concerned, to talk about these issues than Silicon Valley, where so many of the innovative applications have been developed. And right now, we're going to probably see some developers come out, because software developers, because they feel that they can't get financing if these big companies are going to clamp down and make them pay for preferential position for the fast lane on the internet, then they're not going to be able to even get financing to come up with these innovative applications, all kinds of new and exciting programs that people can run over the internet, but they have to get financing too. So that's the kind of issue I think we're going to focus in on at Stanford. At Cambridge, at Harvard, we talked about whether or not some of the shutdown of BitTorrent by Comcast and the effort by Verizon Wireless to stop NARAL from putting out text messages were appropriate or were in violation of FCC rules. And we had a great debate from some of the leading experts in the Internet that are really the fathers of the Internet, from MIT and Harvard. And it's a fascinating debate to have. And it's great that the chairman is out and about doing these hearings, is willing to go out to the people. I think we taught him a good lesson in the media ownership context, and he's learned that one, and he's taking it up.
Commissioner Adelstein, our program, Media Matters, is carried over WILL AM in Champaign-Urbana in Illinois, but we're also carried online. The majority of people who hear this program will be getting it via the Internet and podcasting, and there are also a few other stations that carry the program, including KWMD, and if I get this right, Castleloft, Alaska. We have on line four our toll line right now, Jeremy Landsman from Alaska, from KWMD, who has a question for you. Jeremy, are you there?
I am.
Go ahead with Commissioner Adelstein.
And it's Castleloft, by the way.
Thank you very much. I won't blow it again.
Okay. In this conversation, and actually in my own mind, I think there's an aspect of competition and the kind of programming and that we see that I forgot for sure, and I've been sort of writing my own history here a little bit, and came to mind something called financial syndication rules that were struck down in the early part of the 1990s. And I wonder if Commissioner Adelstein has anything to say about it. Let me sort of preface it by the question laying down the foundation that my view of what is distributed in the way of television programming, and television is the most pervasive and will remain so kind of content, whether it's carried on internet, broadcast television, or what have you, cell phones. It looks to me as though almost all of it is generated by four companies right now. And financial syndication rules were a big part of what used to keep diversity in the program marketplace. So, you know, it's sort of like out of left field, and I'm sorry it's totally off the topic of the internet. But
no, that's quite comments. All right. In fact, if I may interrupt, Jeremy, that's an issue I wanted to get to, because Commissioner Adelstein, the financial syndication rules, I'll spare you the chance to have to explain them. I'll explain to the listeners. These were rules that prohibited the television networks from producing their own primetime shows. They had to buy them from independent companies. And then those companies, they spawned an enormous industry of small production companies in California that competed to win the valuable slots. When they were scrapped in the early 1990s, it led to the massive wave of mergers where all the television networks are now affiliated with a major film studio, and virtually wiped out this entire independent sector of productions of television shows in Hollywood, changed the whole landscape of Hollywood. There's been some pushing, certainly by that whole productions community in Hollywood, that would love to see something like those rules reinstated. What do you think?
Well, there was a great discussion about this during the media ownership debate. The few remaining independent producers, and they are hanging on by their fingernails in Hollywood. There used to be literally dozens, if not hundreds of them, and now there's just two or three that are really doing any independent production, because all the production went in-house to the networks. They run their own in-house production, and it's resulted in the diminishment, as we heard, of independent voices. There was an effort to try to set aside 25% of what the networks put on the air for independent production, independent producers. And there was some interest in doing that, but in the end, it never got off the ground. I mean, me and Mike Copps were very sympathetic to how we would get that implemented. We worked on it. There was even some interest we heard expressed here internally but it never took off. The only thing that really was the obsession of the chairman was relaxing the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rules. So despite the excellent arguments that were made, and we went to one of our hearings, was in Los Angeles, California, and did we hear an earful from the Hollywood community about the lack of independent production of what's on television. I mean, some of the great shows like Bill Cosby and so many others, Archie Bunker, you know, All in the Family, would have never existed if it weren't for the financial interest and syndication rules.
Do you think, Commissioner, that if there were a change in the White House so that you and Commissioner Copps were two-thirds, two of the three majority votes, that this is the sort of rule that might become in play?
I think it certainly would be something that would really rise rapidly in our hierarchy here, and we would dust that off and really take a hard look at whether or not we need to do something to encourage independent production.
Our guest today, Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein from the Federal Communications Commission. It's a live show. We're taking phone calls at 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now to maybe the most patient caller we've had in a very long time. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Jonathan Adelstein.
Oh, actually, I got in real late, but that's okay. I'm particularly honored to be on after Jeremy Landsman. I remember the great days of that Crab Nebula station at KDNA in St. Louis and counted as a very seminal influence in my young formative life in the early 60s, or late 60s, early 70s. So he and his mother did a wonderful job up there, or down there, wherever it is from here. Anyway, I was thinking about Southern Illinois and the floods down there. It reminded me of the story of that particularly made one of the Dakota senators angry about the lack of localism, that they had a flood. I believe it was near the Minnesota border, but there was no station that radiated any kind of live information. There was no way to tell people that they were going to be hit by a flood. And a lot of people, I think maybe a similar thing happened in Southern Illinois. There's probably not enough time for anybody to respond who's down and listening, and this station gets down there, but not in the night. So I just wanted you to maybe reprise that anecdote, but also to mention one of the series of meetings that you had were based on the idea of localism. And I wonder what the FCC can do about promoting local stations. I mean, the internet's fine, and but the idea of integrating a community, you know, locally as well as whatever the internet does for us, is extremely important, it seems to me. As a asterisk, maybe, and I don't know whether you really want to deal with this, but I'm very intrigued that the House committees are still going after the misrepresentation of the evidence and the hearings, and whether that's actually, is there even any, is it only a civil thing? Is it only, I mean, it seems like that was almost a criminal misrepresentation, and I don't know whether you want to go there, so I put that at the very end. Thank you.
Caller, just one quick thing to clarify. You mean with regard to the media ownership?
Well, yeah, there was a whole series of exactly. The studies were entirely misconstrued, and it looked like to me that it couldn't have been any kind of accident, that it had to be willful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, caller. Commissioner?
Well, first on the localism, there's been a real loss of localism on radio in particular. I think you're referring generally to radio, because the consolidation of radio has resulted in people being yanked out of local stations, and they're operated by remote. As Garrison Keillor said in the Prairie Home Companion, pretty soon all will have on the radio is people yelling at each other and computers running music. That's what's been happening as a result of the need to reduce costs. When these companies buy up these stations at very high prices, the only way they can save money is by cutting out the staff. So there's no longer anybody on site actually monitoring the community, and they're just trying to cut costs so they can get the advertising but not actually put anything back into the community. That was the case up in Minot, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a flood, but a train derailment. The train carried anhydrous ammonia, I think it was, which is a fertilizer. But when the train derailed, a toxic cloud headed toward the city of Minot, and the sirens went off in the city because the public safety officials were notified. But people then turned on their radio, as they would have been trained to do over the years, to hear what was going on, and all they heard was oldies or top 40 or whatever the format was of computer-generated music coming from out of town, and there was nobody that the public safety officials could contact to get a hold of the local stations to put the word out because there's nobody there. And there was no way to get a hold of them because nobody was running the show. Nobody was at the stations. So in any event, people actually, they heard the siren. They walked outside of their door to see what was going on. That's exactly the wrong thing. They were supposed to close their doors, close their windows, stay inside, turn out the air conditioning, and wait till this cloud dissipated. So people were, hundreds were hurt by this, and one person died, and the radio was not there to help that community. And in so many cases, you hear about that. I was in a hearing in Albuquerque where we had a live example of that. Somebody who is a witness just from the public that attended the hearing said, I was on my way here, and I saw some smoke near where my house is on this hillside. So I turned on the radio to see if I could get home or if there was something going on, and I couldn't get any information because none of the radio stations were running anything about this fire that was happening in Albuquerque, outside of Albuquerque. So eventually he called around and found out and made it to the hearing because it wasn't affecting him. But he couldn't get the information on the radio to know even how to get to where he needed to go. So these things happen time and again. We're looking at ways to restore localism to radio. The results of that long study that we started in 2003 on localism was just a broad request for comment that the chairman put out on the same day he relaxed the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. So hopefully someday we'll take that up and try to come up with mechanisms to increase localism. Now, on the other topic, whether or not there was any violations of law as a result of some of the distortions of the studies on media ownership, certainly it appears to me that there's ample evidence that the laws requiring proper peer review of studies were not adhered to. In other words, after we did these 10 media ownership studies, before we put them out for the public, you're supposed to do a peer review process. It's supposed to be done according to certain guidelines in the federal law called the Data Quality Act. It's clear to me, I think, that the Data Quality Act was not requirements were not met. Now, this was potentially illegal activity, but it's not criminal. There's no criminal statute that would result from violations of that federal law. So interesting question you raise. I don't know whether other criminal activity will come up as a result of this or not. I mean, you never know with a broad-based investigation. I certainly hope not, but you never know. I mean, certainly we should be held accountable for violations of federal law, whether or not there's a criminal statute involved or not.
We only have around 7 minutes left, Commissioner Adelstein, and there's so much more to cover. But one issue we haven't talked about yet that I know is near and dear to your heart and has been throughout your tenure at the FCC has been the issue of payola, of fake news, of sort of lack of privacy on the Internet. Can you just talk a little bit about these issues and how the FCC has proceeded on them?
Well, when it comes to payola, it's an interesting footnote to history that we had heard all kinds of allegations of payola, and it wasn't until then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, who's been in the news lately, did a major investigation of payola and brought us all kinds of evidence that it was rampant that we were able to actually then come up with the second biggest settlement in the history of the FCC. We got all the four biggest radio networks to agree to pay fines and to come up with a new system to prevent payola. What happens
we should explain what payola is.
I was going to do that. Yeah. What payola is when a radio promoter, for example, or a record company pays a radio station to play something on the air, all they have to do to make it legal is say, this record's brought to you by Warner Brothers, but they don't do that because it's embarrassing. They want to pretend like the music is chosen on merit. Well, apparently there was a lot of payments being made and gifts being given. Right now we, as a result of actually working together with the chairman, we did come up with an historic settlement, and hopefully we're tamping down on that. One of Spitzer's better legacies than the one we've heard about in the last couple of weeks. Certainly many ways that he stepped up to the plate for the public before the incident that we all know led to his demise as a political figure in New York.
How about the fake news front?
On the fake news front, there's a huge investigation now underway on the video news releases. We haven't yet gotten any progress on that, but we're hoping that we'll be able to treat that with the same seriousness with which we treated the payola scandal. That is, that these companies, PR companies, will put out a video news release that a TV station will run unedited even though it was designed to sell a product, like some drug. You know, here's a little mini piece that looks like a news story on some miracle hand cream, and all of a sudden you see it on your local news, and you don't realize that it's an ad. Now, the local broadcaster might not have been paid for it, but they did, rather than having to pay a reporter to go out and run a news story, they used that valuable video news release to fill the what they call the news hole, to put something out there. It's just what they're doing is using these prepackaged news stories because they don't have the resources. They've cut back on local news staffs, as we talked about, and they don't have the ability to go out and do their own reporting, so they just throw in some PR piece that they're sent over the transom and never tell the public that this is paid for by some large pharmaceutical company or by some other organization. So all they need to do is disclose. I mean, our rules require they tell the public if anybody gives them something valuable in exchange for putting something on the air.
And Commissioner, finally, in the last minute or so, one of the real emerging issues on the Internet is the question of privacy. How much people, these companies, when you go online, these websites and ISPs and phone and cable companies get to learn about us and what we do online. Is this an issue the FCC has any interest in?
We have enormous interest in it. We haven't done much about it. One of our laws requires that we ensure that these telecommunications providers don't give out personally identifiable information or misuse the private information they get from their customers. I mean, the biggest scandal about it was the warrantless wiretapping that you're now hearing about in Congress, and we never even investigated that. I mean, we never even looked into it because the chairman said, well, that's national security, can't go there. So we have some role when it comes to telecommunications carriers. On the Internet, we've deregulated it to the point that we don't have a lot of say over it. The Federal Trade Commission has more jurisdiction. They can oversee to ensure that if a company has a privacy statement, that they actually adhere to it. And if they don't, that's misleading or false advertising, and they could be prosecuted under some of the FTC fraud statutes. But we need to look at, into that. We need to continue to stay on top of it. It's an issue of enormous concern to the people.
Commissioner Adelstein, we've only got a minute left. Between now and the end of the year, what are the big issues that are going to be before the Federal Communications Commission, especially if there are some we haven't talked about?
Well, we are going to be dealing with net neutrality and how we deal with some of the complaints that are pending. We're going to be looking at universal service, which is our program to ensure that everybody in the United States has access to an affordable phone service at comparable rates and quality across the country to help rural areas. And ultimately, that is something we want to transform into a national broadband policy. Me and Commissioner Copps have been, again, the lone two voices saying we need a national broadband policy, and we're going to see what we can do in the next year to set it up that we begin to compete again in broadband so we're not number 20, so we restore ourselves to being number one in the world, and universal service is one of the ways we're going to get there.
And yourself, what do you do to stay on top of these issues? Where do you get your information? Do you use news media at all, or is it all internal information you get to draw your expert opinions?
I read three newspapers a day, the Post, the Times, and the Journal, Wall Street Journal, and of course I have three professional lawyers who get me all kinds of great information, and we look at the trade press, which is helpful, but we also get filings on particular issues from all of the affected parties. Now, sometimes, like we'd said earlier, it's just the companies that are affected that on a technical spectrum issue, for example, we'll get briefs from all the different sides and we have to read through them. So we get voluminous information from a lot of different sources, and I like to give special weight to what we hear from public interest groups like Free Press, which you hope to co-found. I just had Free Press in my office last week. They were here talking to me and providing materials about net neutrality and open Internet, keeping Internet freedom alive for generations to come. So we do hear from the public interest side as well, but they're a small, hardy band compared to the army of lobbyists who trudge through here with their Gucci loafers every day.
Commissioner Adelstein, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to kick me out of the office, let someone else in here for their show. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Well, thanks for everything you do, Bob. You're fantastic.
Thank you. And I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. I'll be back in 167 hours. Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners, or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, Dan Pounder says a chance of snow, the high 42 degrees, with wind from the north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, considerably cloudy, the low 26 degrees, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with a high of 46 degrees, west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The controversy surrounding Senator Barack Obama and his minister continues to spur intense debate about race, religion, and even politics. But what about the notion of liberation theology? We'll talk about it.
Wright tries to lay out a series of facts about the history of foreign policy on the part of our government and then the blowback violence of that factual history.
I can give you some statements from King that would be as radical and as offensive as Dr. Wright's was.
Also, we continue with the sixth installment of our special series, Below the Line, The Changing Face of American Poverty, as we hear about some of the challenges facing some families in Alligator, Mississippi. Plus, singer-songwriter Angelique Kijo joins us to celebrate her recent Grammy win.